From Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse, this is Newsmakers. I'm John Gatto. We're considering the need for and a definition of a water ethic on this edition of Newsmakers. It was the focus of a two-day conference on water ethics held in La Crosse in April, and it was clear from the conversations and presentations that took place those 2 days that there's a growing need to better understand just how important this natural resource is, not just in a major watershed like the Mississippi, but frankly, to humanity worldwide. Scholars, students, and professionals attended the conference, hearing stories about water scarcity, pollution, and also successes in protecting water, all of which inform what we're trying to define as a water ethic. Kurt Meine is, among other things, a conservation biologist, an adjunct professor at UW-Madison and senior fellow with the Alda Leopold Foundation, and author of the biography, Alda Leopold, His Life and Work. He's among those who connect this growing interest in a water ethic back to Leopold and his land ethic that grew out of his popular book, A Sand County Almanac. So, what is it about Leopold that leads us to thinking about the ethics of water?
We remember Aldo Leopold as a great voice for what he called the land ethic, this idea that the land is a community that includes people and that our human communities include the land, and that we are members of the land community. And he came to that idea and understanding, along with many other people, as the science of ecology developed, as conservation movement grew and changed. But it was pretty late in his life that he began to define it as this concept, in terms of this concept called the land ethic. And he's very associated with that terminology. But he himself was very explicit in saying an ethic is not the product of any one human being's, mind and heart. It's an expression of a community's coming to understanding of proper relationship. So in his own essay, The Land Ethic, he says nothing so important as an ethic is ever written. It evolves in the minds of a thinking community, because it makes the point that no one person does this, and that it's constantly changing and evolving. And that's how Leopold understood this idea. He was going to do his best to attempt to capture it, maybe like capture a snapshot of the idea, but he knew that it had sources going back into history and that it had potential going forward in history. And another major theme is water. Leopold included water in his definition of land. He described land as not just soil, it's soils, waters, plants, and animals, and people together in a community. So water was part of it.
And yet we quite literally think of the land ethic as just being land, many of us.
We tend to think of it as in terrestrial terms.
Yeah.
And so a lot of folks are building on that concept to say, well, soil is there, but water is an equally important part, obviously. And so it's not something different from what Leopold defined, but it's a re-emphasis on a dimension of it, a facet of it, and that is water. And in the last 10 years, there's been a really remarkable growth of interest in the concept of a water ethic. And it's not disconnected from another theme, and that is similarly, there's been a growth of interest in oceans and the marine environment. So there's a lot of discussion of an ocean ethic. And of course, oceans and water, it's all connected. We all know that.
Right.
But it's interesting to see what parts of the whole we think we need to turn a little more attention to keep a good, proper balance.
Yeah.
And water has certainly been rising.
Your address to the conference entitled Water Ethics Emerging, A Confluence of Traditions and Values. You just touched on some of the traditions and the values that come with each of those. The water ethics emerging part of it, is it that a water ethic is just taking shape, or is it just that a water ethic is emerging in terms of greater awareness, being influenced in definition perhaps by the traditions, the values, and what we're faced with in the here and now?
Yeah, sure. We can see that obviously there are issues in the news every day of a water crisis of some sort. So there's always a prompt from the latest bad headline, a drought in California, a flood in here or there, a pollution issue. So there's sort of that negative prompt of, oh my, something's bad happening and we need a new way of behaving in order to cure it. But there's also more and more, you know, a balance of understanding. There's also positive things happening, that we can understand how water can heal itself and can heal our communities if we change our behavior. So there's good stories of water in our landscape that has been restored. And right here, we're in La Crosse, so just 10 miles down the road is Coon Valley, Wisconsin, a story I know very well from my work on Leopold. And here's one of the great stories in the U.S., if not the world, on how in a small community starting in the 1930s, several hundred farmers and others came together and helped to heal a whole watershed. Not a huge watershed. That's what makes it understandable. You can almost see the whole thing.
Yeah.
But that it's such a great story for that reason. And many of those farm families are still there and still have that ethic that began to grow two or three generations ago. So there's positive stories that prompt the emerging or re-emerging or emphasis on a water ethic. And then there's the prompting that comes from just knowing that this is now a global issue. It's always local, because water is also local, but it also connects us to the global cycles of water.
How do we take these huge parameters of what surrounds us and make it into something sensible for right here along the Mississippi, the La Crosse River, the Black River, the Root River?
Well, that's one of the wonderfully imaginative things that water helps us do. It helps us to see our place in a different way. We all have our intimate connections in the places we know, live in, work, play in, live and die in. But we can understand through water that we're all embedded in larger and larger scales of space and time, if you want to think of it that way.
Yes.
We are nested. So the little Coon Valley, Coon Creek watershed is nested within the upper Mississippi, which is nested within the whole Mississippi watershed, which is nested within what the poet Gary Snyder calls the one big watershed.
Yes.
The earth is one big watershed, ultimately. But that gives you that sense of proportionality and connectedness. So one, I came up with a line on this that I sometimes use in my talks where you know, we know we live in divided times, and we can focus on those things. So in addressing that, my line is we can dwell on those things that divide us, but we dwell in landscapes that connect us. Mm-hmm. And we're essentially connected more than almost anything else by water. There are other things, obviously, that connect us, but water is physical, it's real, it's a tangible thing that we know connects us. So that I may be here in La Crosse right now, but I know that way off in the mountains of North Carolina, on the east edge of the Mississippi watershed, and way out west on the Continental Divide in Montana, we're all part of the same big Mississippi River watershed. And that no matter where you are, and no matter how small or large your community, no matter if it's just your backyard, 20 square feet, or it's a 1,000-acre ranch out in Colorado, we are all part of the watershed. Its condition, its health, reflects what all of us do within that watershed, how we act and how we treat each other and how we treat the land and how we treat the water. And that helps us to see that, my part is important. It's as important as anyone else's part.
This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm John Gatto. We're talking with Kurt Miney, one of the presenters at the 2015 Water Ethics Conference held in April at Viterbo University. He's a conservation biologist, educator, historian, author, and fellow with the Alda Leopold Foundation and with the Center for Humans and Nature. One of the themes that surfaced a few times at the conference, to pick up on what you were just saying, is that we all wake up in the morning and we recognize that we have certain water rights, whether it's taking a shower or heating water for our coffee or tea, or going out fishing for the day, or kayaking, or whatever it might be. We have those rights. But what we don't often think about are those responsibilities. Mm-hmm. I guess that's part of what this whole conversation about a water ethic is also trying to raise, that other part of the question, or the other part of the equation.
Right. I mean, ethics is about our relationships in community and what responsibilities that entails, and rights, but all, and privileges, but also what does it require of us. our relationships to one another, other people, our relationships to future generations of people, our relationships to other living things, and even for some, the relationship to the water itself. I mean, we are bound up in this web of relationships. And if we do not pay attention to our responsibilities, it comes right back to us. This is sort of basic environmental thinking, right? Something we grow up with. And usually we don't deal directly with that. Those consequences are often deferred, or they don't hit you back directly, or someone else pays the costs. Someone else will take responsibility for doing the cleanup, whatever. But then every once in a while, it comes back and hits us directly. And that's when we wake up and realize, you know, this really is about, I should say, it's not just about me and my rights. It is about us and our responsibilities.
And the common good is what we hear many talk about.
The common good, the public interest, the general welfare, these terms we use to talk about our commitments to the communities that we participate in. And those communities, again, are not just human communities. They're human and natural communities bound up together.
When we talk about the places where we live, again, another idea that surfaced during the conference was that we can talk about a water ethic, which makes us think that, oh, there's a single water ethic. But the notion that that's really not very likely or practical, that communities need to define their own. Does that splinter the notion?
It's a great question. Not that I have any answer, really, because I think we are still observing, watching, and finding our way forward on this. There are different traditions of care and respect for water that come from the global religions, from schools of philosophy, from different disciplinary understandings in the sciences. That's what I mean about this confluence of values and traditions. It's flowing together now, and it's flowing more than it has in my experience around the general theme of a water ethic. And we don't know how it's all going to compare, how it's all going to fall out. We know that we can enrich each other's understanding by seeing it through a different set of eyes and a different set of experiences.
Cultures and whatnot.
Exactly. And we'll need to compare and see how we can come to a common understanding. There has to be some level of universality to this, because guess what? It's one body of water on Earth. It's this, the Hindus on the Ganges and the Ojibwe in Lake Itasca and the Inuit in Alaska.
Right.
They all have a tradition of water respect and reverence, and it's the same water. And maybe for the first time in human history, we not only understand the entirety of the global hydrological cycle as the water circulates around and around and around forever, but maybe also now we understand there's a global ethical cycle that all these traditions are feeding in and out of each other in some way that we don't fully grasp, and we are ourselves helping to create. It doesn't mean you're going to lose your local traditions or your own community's contribution. In fact, it will strengthen it by giving it connection, maybe. Because there is no one ethic, as you say, and yet we understand there's connectivity.
So in the end, how do we shape these conversations into action, and to what end?
That's a very good question, and it's the essential one. There's two parts to it. How do we shape it and how do we activate it? How do we shape it? The first thing that comes to my mind is we listen. We just listen and listen and listen to each other. And we withhold ourselves a little bit so that we can open our ears and hear what someone coming from a different way of understanding the world with a different voice, what they have to offer. So that helps us understand how what we have to offer in return. And we sometimes can purposefully shape this conversation. Other times we seize the moment when it comes, the teachable moments that happen in our lives and our landscapes. I'll give you an example. We know that the best predictions of how our climate is going to be changing show that we're likely to get more intense precipitation events in this region, in the upper Midwest. And it's happened.
Right. And our climatologists are showing that to us all the time.
And in my own community back in central Wisconsin, we had a massive flood a few years back, 2008, that fit every model and prediction. It was a sort of a warning sign of what we can expect more of. But we missed the teachable moment. We didn't talk about how this 8 to 10 inches of rain that fell in one day and ripped out the roads and the bridges and gullied up the fields. We didn't learn much from that. And there was not a discussion in our community about it. So we missed that moment. It could have shaped a whole new way of talking about water in our landscape, but we failed it. It doesn't mean that we're unattentive or uncaring. It just means people are busy. So maybe one thing is to take those moments, whether it's a drought in California or flooding on the river or whatever, to understand this, to look at the history. Again, when you're in a region like this with water defining the upper Mississippi, Coon Valley, La Crosse, this is a water landscape. Seizing that opportunity. But then how do you activate it? That's always the question. I think it has to do, you don't want to be in my view, in a position of just responding to the latest crisis.
Right.
And that's always reactive. What I think we all want to be is proactive. We want to be able to make this a daily discipline rather than a 100-year flood event response or a drought response. We want to be able to build into our daily lives, into our way our communities work, and into the ways we interact with water everywhere, a discipline. That's a rather harsh term. Maybe we call it a celebration. It's the same thing, but a celebration of water and the honoring of water so that we don't have to be in that mode of just reacting, but that as the more we understand our relationship with water, the more we can honor that relationship and evolve it in a way that prevents the crises instead of always reacting to them.
Does that come from, on a local basis, from our elected officials, our cities, our counties?
There's always the role of policy and all that at all those levels, and we need that at every level. We are a democracy, and if we are good citizens in a democracy, we have to be involved in policy. Not all, many of us like it, but it is part of our responsibility. Also, it's another ethic, and that is of self-governing.
Well, and part of my question, I should have said, do we wait on that?
No, because that's one expression of our roles, in my view, as citizens and people. It starts with connecting with water. You know, if you're a teacher or a parent, you know, it's getting your kids out to connect with water in a real, tangible way, so that it isn't something that you are told you have to care about, but it's something that comes from within, that you develop a relationship. Sometimes I do with this with students. When I'm supposed to be giving my formal lecture on water and ethics, I won't start by saying, here's what you need to know about water and ethics. I'll stop and say, let us be quiet for a minute. And I want you to close your eyes, and I want you to think of the most important body of water in your life. And I let it sit there just like we did right now. And that's the way of making a point and saying, you think you don't have an ethic about water? Guess what? You do, because you care about a place that has water. It's shaped you. It means you have a relationship with water. And if you have a relationship, that means you have an ethic. And it makes the point. And most kids do. All of us who grew up splashing in water, fishing, whatever we do, we have a relationship. And it's simple a matter of being attentive to that relationship and building and focusing on, instead of taking it for granted, and taking the time to honor that relationship. And if you do that, everything else follows. All the policy stuff follows. If you don't care, there's not a caring foundation for all this, then all of that doesn't make any difference. So without that essential element, all the rest of it is dependent on that.
Kurt Miney is a conservation biologist, a writer and historian, an adjunct professor at UW-Madison, and senior fellow with Wisconsin's Alda Leopold Foundation. You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm John Gatto. We'll close this discussion with a final word from one other presenter at the 2015 Water Ethics Conference at Viterbo University. Jane Elder is Executive Director of the Wisconsin Academy of Sciences, Arts, and Letters, an independent nonprofit organization that produces programs and publications that explore, explain, and sustain Wisconsin's thought and culture. You make the point, Jane, that everybody has both rights and responsibilities when it comes to water.
Absolutely.
And that things will be addressed only if there's active involvement and participation by citizens. And this includes, I suspect, part of this need to address some of those ethical considerations of water as well. That's kind of where you see it happening?
Yeah, I think, you know, it starts at the level of what's the right thing to do. At least I hope it does for most people. And part of it is just being aware that every decision we make about water as individuals or as a community or as a business, as a farmer, affects somebody else and it affects future generations. And I think there is a strong conservation ethic in Wisconsin. I think we need to talk about today's issues in the context of that cultural ethic that we carry with us and the complexity of today's issues. It's not just about doing the right thing on my land or in my household. It's these things that are ubiquitous that we need to pull together on. You know, I eat food that I know is produced with fertilizer somewhere, right? I drive a car. Now, granted, she's a hybrid, but I drive a car that I know is contributing to carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. But I try to be conscious about my choices, and I think people want to do the right thing. We need to talk about the complexities of today's issues, how it is that we've come to a point where we have a dead zone in Green Bay again, and where the water we drink and what goes down our drain, how that's affecting lives downstream as far as the Gulf of Mexico. And I think people are inclined to do what they can if they know that it's going to make a difference and it's going to leave the world a better place. Sometimes having the ability to make those decisions, or sometimes there are other pressures on you, whether they're economic pressures, sometimes peer pressure. How is it that we came to love water in plastic bottles? I don't know. So being able to talk about water as something that we share responsibility for counts. It's also, I think, in a water state, important to experience water. And when you love a place, and when you love a river or a lake or that special pond, or you have those memories and connections, you realize that when you love something, you carry with it a responsibility to take care of it as well. And the more that we can help people love the waters in this state and enjoy them, I think that's the roots of our conservation legacy. We love this place. It's home. And we want home to be beautiful, we want home to be safe, and we want it to be the place that we're proud of. And by taking care of our waters, Wisconsin can always be that place. But we've got some challenges right now, and we need to step up to those challenges so that future generations will also say they love it here.
Do we imagine that there is a single water ethic?
You know, I think it boils down to doing the right thing for your family, for the future, and for your neighbors. And those neighbors include all living things. For me, that's the simplest way I can look at the ethic, that no drop of water belongs to any of us. There's a finite amount of water on Earth. That's the way it's been since the planet's been around. We don't get to get any more of it. So the water that we do have is the water that we take care of. And if we do that, everyone's always going to have what they need and it will be clean. We're not there now. So we have some work to do, but I think it's realizing it's not ours, it's everybody's forever. And if we can take care of it, everyone benefits. If we don't, most of us don't benefit and can get hurt in some pretty serious ways.
Jane Elder, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Academy of Sciences, Arts, and Letters, co-sponsor of the 2015 Conference on Water Ethics held at La Crosse in April. The event was hosted and co-sponsored by the D.B. Reinhardt Institute for Ethics and Leadership at Viterbo University. This conversation on water ethics continues on our website, wpr.org/newsmakers, where you can hear extended interviews with conference participants and find links to other conference materials and archives of this program. That's all at wpr.org/newsmakers. And that wraps up this edition of Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm John Gatto. Our production team includes Maureen McCollum, Mary Meehan Strube, and our senior news editor and producer, John Davis. Our website, by the way, also includes archives of other recent editions of Newsmakers. And if you'd like to share comments or make suggestions for future shows, you'll find links to our producers and staff. That and more at wpr.org/newsmakers.